We are reading the Bible cover to cover in 2017, and I've made a schedule with quizzes at bibleandjive.blogspot.com. Turn in a quiz each month, earn a fabulous prize. And there are also going to be discussion opportunities for talking about what we've read. Once per month, after worship, we'll spend about 45 minutes or so having a conversation about it. So go get a cup of coffee and come back. We'll talk about it till about noon or so. And the first discussion will be May 21st, following worship. And in addition to the discussions, I'm also going to use the worship services between now and pretty much the end of the year as an opportunity to use sermons and liturgy and poetry and whatnot to offer perspectives on the Bible readings. So today I'm going to start from the beginning, and I'm going to spend 4 weeks on the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And the idea here is that even if you haven't read any of the Bible or don't plan to, it'll still be entertaining, I hope. And if you have read it, this will give some context and reflection on what you've read. And for each sermon, I'll offer brief technical stuff, just enough to get us through, historical background, literary structure, whatever. I will also include some theological reflection. But my theological reflection isn't necessarily Calvinism. And it won't be about God, whatever that means exactly. And this is going to come up often. There is a literary character in the book called God, or the Lord, or Yahweh, or Elohim. This character did not write or cause humans to write the books of the Bible. This is a character created by the storytellers, although perhaps not consciously. Yahweh or Elohim is a character inherited by and shaped by the biblical storytellers. So my theological reflection is not about the character God as much as on how this literature as a whole, there's the deal, both reveals and conceals the myths that drive us. I had a conversation with Arthur Dewey of the Jesus Seminar, and he said that modern people, that is us, lack a language for what's happening to us. The ancients had the language of myth, and so when they fell in love, they knew that they were being visited by Aphrodite. Today we talk about glands. It isn't quite the same. And so there is a mythology. We don't have to adopt it, but there's something there to draw from as well as we create our own, to inspire us, to create the language, to reveal the myths that drive us. So we're listening in on conversations that these ancients had between themselves when we read the Bible. These conversations are hard to understand, even when we think it's clear. And we will find much of it boring, much of it offensive to our sensibilities. But I also hope once in a while we might say, that helps explain something that's happening in our world. The interesting thing, in my opinion, about the Bible is not that it's a supernatural book or a word of God or a guide for living or any of that. It has instead shaped Western consciousness, even for those who've never read it. And so I'm hoping that reading it critically will remove some of the mystique that surrounds it, and I'm also hoping that reading it critically will liberate us from it, even as reading it may help us to understand what makes us tick. The Bible is, in a sense, a family history. And for those of you who have done some genealogy, you may have run across characters in your family tree that explain how you or other family members are the way they are. I learned a lot about myself by uncovering the story of my great-grandfather. The Bible sometimes can be like that. We are learning about one branch, yet a very prominent branch on our family tree. And we may find uncomfortable truths about ourselves within the Bible. Patriarchy and sexual control, manifest destiny and exceptionalism, war and violence, racism and intolerance. We also may find inspiring truths in unexpected places. Compassion and altruism, possibility for the underdog, courageous truth-telling to the powers that be. So this first month is on the Torah, and this first week is on the book of Genesis, and in particular we'll take a look at the story of Jacob, who receives a new name, Israel. So what's the plot? Well, it begins with the creation of the world by Elohim, which is plural for God, by gods, also known as Yahweh. And Yahweh creates the first human beings, Adam and Eve, who discover their limits, ultimately mortality, and they thus begin humanity's quest for home, for a name, for purpose, for immortality. And Yahweh, we find in the book of Genesis, likes to make deals. And after he, and I'm sorry, regarding all the work that we've done on inclusive language, Yahweh really is a he. This is the religion of patriarchy. And I don't think it's liberating to deny that by trying to call Yahweh a she. Now, if divinity is important to you, then divine images and stories of feminine characters are important to find. Sadly, not a lot of them are found in the Bible. There are some notable exceptions, but if we want feminine images for God, we'll likely have to go outside the Bible for the most part. The Bible is, like it or not, patriarchal. And if we seek liberation from patriarchy, we can't deny that the problem is within the text itself. Yahweh's a deal maker, a covenant maker. And the Torah is all about making deals. And Yahweh makes his first deal with Eve and Adam. You get the garden and all the produce except for the fruit from this one tree, this tree of moral agency, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But Yahweh doesn't realize who he's dealing with, who he's created. These human beings have self-consciousness and intelligence, and they are curious, and they're not satisfied about being placed in gardens. So they break the deal. They eat the forbidden fruit, and Yahweh banishes them because Yahweh's afraid of them. They might now eat from the tree of life, become immortal, and compete with him. So he limits their lifespans, invents childbirth, male dominance, and sends them out east of Eden. One day, Yahweh is looking down from his perch in the dome of the sky, and he sees that the human beings, in his view, are behaving badly. And so he destroys the entire planet, humans, animals, everything, with a flood, except for one family and representatives of each species of animal. Noah and his family, Noah's wife and three sons and three daughters-in-law, and all the critters board the ark and are saved. And when the ark lands, Yahweh becomes self-reflective. That didn't help matters. Humans are still bad. So he makes a deal. He makes a covenant with Noah that he will not destroy the earth again, no matter how bad humans get. And when he gets a hankering to do so, he will remember not to do it because he will look at the rainbow that he put in the sky and remember. The rainbow is for Yahweh to remember. So when humans see the rainbow, they can say to themselves, Yahweh sees it too, and because of that, he won't wipe us out. Remember that, Yahweh. That's covenant number one. It is a universal covenant. It's for all human beings, not just a select group, and it's a perpetual covenant, meaning it's forever. It's not conditioned on human beings doing their part. So Yahweh will not destroy the human race no matter how bad we get. So, does that mean we can trash the place and Yahweh's will always save us in the end? Some people might interpret this deal in that way. Sometimes this covenant is interpreted alongside the Christian covenant, the New Testament, that Yahweh, who at that point morphed into God the Father, makes with humanity through his Son, Jesus the Messiah, or Jesus the Christ. And in that covenant, Jesus Christ returns, or will return, and make a new heaven and a new earth. So those who make the deal will live with Jesus and Father forever. Some have thought that means we don't have to care about the long-term survival of humanity and future generations on earth because Jesus is coming back soon, and Yahweh promised not to destroy us till then. So do some people really believe that? Well, according to polls, about 40% of Americans believe that Christ will return in their own lifetimes. Where do these beliefs come from? The Bible. The Bible read uncritically. It's more dangerous when people in power, whether in government or in industry, believe that, or at least use that as a justification for their destructive energy and environmental policies. God won't destroy humanity no matter what global warming Cassandras tell us. So let's dig it out and burn it up, and when the party's over, come Lord Jesus. I'm getting ahead of myself. We have more covenants to deal with in Genesis before the day is done. Noah, all right, remember his children, three sons and three daughters-in-law. Well, they have lots of kids, and humanity spreads out over the face of the earth, but they all have one language and one grammar. And so one day, Yahweh, again, up in his perch, is looking down, and he sees humans building a tower to heaven. Now, heaven is another word for sky, or dome, or firmament above. So I really want to imprint this kind of picture. It helps us understand what the Bible's talking about. They didn't live in our universe. You know, it's really since my dad's lifetime that our universe expanded from the Milky Way to billions of galaxies beyond that. That's a huge deal. Well, back in the time in which the Bible was written, everybody in the ancient Near East saw that that's a firm thing up there, and the earth is flat, kind of like a circle. And then there are the mountains, and then there's the sea, and outside the firmament is water, and below is water. So it's water that surrounds the little that little thing you shake at Christmas, right, and it snows. That's what the earth was understood to be. And every now and then when it rains, the little portals open up, and the moon and the sun scoot around inside the firmament. And so when Noah is on his ark, basically it's filling up. The water got in, and so it's kind of filling up, and so the ark's bouncing along the tops, and when it finally lands, the water comes down again. So there's always this constant fear that the world was just going to fill up with water and they'd be done. So you can imagine building a ladder to the sky. It isn't just silly. One could imagine that happening in that universe. Seems silly to us, but it could be done. And Yahweh's not happy with that prospect. Not because they are silly, but because they actually might do it. And that would be bad, to have humans knocking at Yahweh's gate, kind of like Jack climbing the beanstalk and sneaking into the giant's castle. So Yahweh messes up their ability to communicate, and he gives them all different languages. No tower gets built. And the result is that human beings speak all kinds of different languages and are divided and scattered across the earth. And they have no way to get to heaven. No way to get to Yahweh. And so Yahweh, I think, is lonely. Yahweh wants some kind of relationship with human beings, but on his terms, not theirs. So Yahweh decides to make a deal with a single individual, Abram. And Yahweh renames him Abraham. And Yahweh summons Abram, and he says, here's the deal. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sands on the beach, and I will give you a piece of property. And you will get a name for yourself. You don't need to build a tower to heaven to get immortality. You get immortality by having a legacy, land and descendants. And you'll be a blessing to the whole world. I'm on your team. I will curse those who curse you, bless those who bless you. Here's the text from Genesis chapter 12, 1. Yahweh said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land I will show you. I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you, make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. The one who curses you, I will curse. In you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And Yahweh makes the covenant again with Abraham a couple of more times throughout the Abraham story, promising a son, requiring on Abraham's part trust. That's all. The covenant is particular, not universal. It's to Abraham, not to all of humanity. Or we might say to all of humanity through Abraham. But the covenant is also unconditional for the most part. Abraham does need to trust, but Yahweh will do what Yahweh wants anyway. So Abraham doesn't need to do anything in particular except to trust Yahweh. And thus we are introduced to exceptionalism. There are people who are chosen and people not chosen. People who have special favor with Yahweh, who believe they are divinely entitled to stuff, land, and those who are not. Exceptionalism plays a huge part in Western history, and in particular, the history and self-understanding of European Americans, as well as the modern state of Israel. We'll be coming back to this on our quest through the Bible. Exceptionalism has a major part to play. But the long story short, Abraham does have children. He has lots of them. And he starts having them when he's like 90. But two of them are of interest to us, Ishmael and Isaac. Abraham and Sarah have a son, Isaac. Before that one, Abraham and Hagar, Sarah's handmaid, have a son, Ishmael. But Yahweh doesn't make a deal there. Yahweh makes a deal with Isaac. And Abraham proves his faithfulness to Yahweh by attempting to kill Isaac. Now we have the legacy of patriarchy. Sarah never gets a say in regards to Abraham's attempted murder of her son. Does that ever bug anybody? Patriarchy means that Abraham's seed is planted in the ground of Sarah. The seed belongs to Abraham. We'll be coming back to that also on our quest through the Bible, as this provides the ancient understanding of biology that ultimately allowed for the doctrine of the virgin birth. Only the male has the seed. The female is the vessel. Biology's changed a little bit since then. We also have a legacy of violence, of fathers over sons, of duty, sacrifice of fathers over sons. But anyway, Isaac survives the ordeal. He marries Rebekah, and he has two sons, Esau and Jacob, who are twins. Jacob is born second, clinging to the heel of his brother as he comes out of the womb, so goes the tale. And Jacob is thus a heel, and he tricks his brother out of his birthright and realizes he needs to get out of town. So he goes to sleep, and he dreams of a ladder ascending to heaven. Remember the tower that never made it to heaven? Well, Jacob's ladder does get there. Jacob wakes up from the dream and thinks he's pretty special. And he is, despite himself. In the dream, Yahweh makes the same deal he made with Isaac and Abraham, land and descendants. And Jacob is inspired to make his own deal with Yahweh. So he wakes up, packs his bag, makes an altar from the rock that he slept on, and then he says, "If you go with me and watch over me as I travel, and if you give me food and clothes and bring me safely home again, you'll be my God, and this rock will be your house, and I will give you back a tenth of everything you give me." So Jacob makes the covenant with Yahweh and sets the terms. Kind of reminds me of Donald Trump. "I'm going to make a deal. I'm building a ladder all the way to heaven, and Yahweh's going to pay for it." But Yahweh doesn't respond to Jacob's deal. He doesn't agree or disagree to Jacob's terms. We're introduced to another ongoing theme in the Bible, and that's the power struggle between Israel and Yahweh. Jacob spends 14 years working for his uncle Laban, and he gets two wives, Leah and Rachel. And between the two wives and their two handmaidens, by the way, have anybody seen Margaret Atwood's A Handmaid's Tale? It's now on Hulu. Yeah. It's good stuff. That's scary stuff. Watch it. Her book was great, but this has been modernized. And talk about what could happen. First people who lose are women when we go into fascism. Okay. But between the two wives and their two handmaidens, Jacob has one daughter and 12 sons. And when he's ready to leave his uncle's house, Yahweh wrestles with him at the river Jabbok. He wounds Jacob, and he gives him a new name, Israel, which means one who struggles or fights with God. And that will be the relationship between Yahweh and ultimately the nation of Israel, a struggle. So when we read in the Bible phrases like the house of Jacob, it's referring to Israel. Jacob's character, a schemer, a deal maker, and a fighter, is just the kind of character with whom Yahweh can do something. Jacob has personality, he has ambition, and Yahweh seems to think he can work with that. And so Jacob becomes the persona of Israel itself and a model for the kind of trust that will define it and those who also claim ancient Israel as an ancestor. Trust is struggle. It's an ongoing wrestling match, a fight with Yahweh. Robert Frost said, "I had a lover's quarrel with the world. Life is a struggle, a competition, a wrestling match, a lover's quarrel between light and dark, yin and yang, male and female, life and death, mortality and immortality, Jacob and Yahweh." Jacob's 12 sons become the 12 tribes of Israel. And one of Jacob's sons, Joseph, is sold to slavery by his other brothers. And he lands in Egypt, makes good, and eventually is the one who brings all of the clan down to Egypt. There, Jacob dies. Joseph also dies, and all of his brothers. Time passes. A Pharaoh arises that, according to the text, did not know Joseph. That is, did not know that the deal that the Hebrew people, Israel, made with the previous Pharaoh, and the Hebrew people become slaves. And that's next week's story in the book of Exodus. But today, covenant is the word for the day. Deals between Yahweh and humans. I'm going to close with Harold Bloom's last sentence in his book, Jesus and Yahweh, the Names Divine. Bloom is speaking of Yahweh both present and absent. And Bloom reflects on the human need for transcendence. Perhaps needing it is unwise, he says, but it is what keeps us from entropy. Can we trust it? Can we trust Yahweh and Jesus and their deals? After holocausts and the modern cosmos, violence, inequality, the end of fossil fuels, nuclear weapons, global warming, and Jesus not seeming to return, says Bloom, will he yet make a covenant with us that he both can and will keep? Welcome to this strange world of the Bible.